much, members, for being back. We have Mr. Desmond Peterson, the independent member of the public, who's going to make a presentation to us. We are welcome, sir, and you may proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, the other members of the committee. Just to clarify, you correctly refer to me as a member of the public, but just in our submission, there's a number of people that have been part of this presentation. Essentially, old trade unionists, activists, trade union educators, and so forth. Some are retired, stopped working, but were drawn out of retirement once they saw the submission. And some of them, as I said, are still working. So, just a comment of, you know, just an introduction as to who the people are. Then also, Madam Chair, just before I actually get into the actual comments that we've submitted, just a comment about the process, just to raise a little bit of a concern about the process. We, you know, the sort of public have been informed that there's a date of implementation of the 1st of May of the national minimum wage. Our presentation is or comments are directed at the issue of the national minimum wage only. And we are a little bit concerned that, you know, a date has been announced and there's a public participation process underway now. So, you know, we obviously would like an undertaking that some assurances that our comments, our submissions will be taken seriously. So just as a starting introduction on those issues, Chair. Chair, when we go into our comments, there's a submission that I think everybody has, so I'm not really going to be dealing with each and every everything that's written in the submission is there, but maybe just to draw out and punctuate some of the things that we feel are important. Now, we start our introduction by referring to the recent decision of the National Assembly regarding the expropriation of land without compensation. And, you know, people will probably be saying, now, what has this got to do with the minimum wage? We think it's got a lot to do with the minimum wage. The President, in his address, referred to the land issue as the original sin. And we are arguing that there are more sins that followed from that. There are sins that followed in the sense that this land was used to build factories, to build farms, walls, and this is exactly the place where our people are being exploited, continue to be exploited. So we just wanted to contextualize that thing, that it's the original sin, and we are pleased that the National Assembly has taken a stance around that original sin, but we think there are other sins that also need to be addressed. And that is the issue of the exploitation of workers. So, in saying that, Chair, we're going to deal with five aspects of the bill. The first one is the issue of the minimum wage. Now, the preamble of the bill confirms that South Africa is one of the most unequal societies in the world, and there are huge disparities in income in the national labour market. And there's a need to eradicate poverty and inequality. Okay? So, on that basis, Chair, we've used a research document which we think is the document that was also used by the drafters of the bill around the earnings of workers. And the document makes talks about the working poor line. And the working poor line is 4,317 at 2016 rates. Now, the proposed national minimum wage of 20 hours, projected as 3,250 rand per month, based on an 8-hour working day, 22 days a month, not only falls short of the working poor line of 4,317 based on figures of February 2016, 2 years ago, but actually undermines the very stated purpose of the bill, namely improving the wages of the lowest paid workers and protecting workers from unreasonably low wages. The setting of the minimum wage at the low rate of 20 rand per hour is usually driven by suggestions that if it were higher, it would increase unemployment and that employers will not be able to afford such rates. But such suggestions cannot and should not influence the setting of minimum wage well above the 20 rand per hour, proposed for the following reasons. If a minimum wage is set below even the working poor rate, then the proposed minimum wage will lock workers into poverty. The ever-increasing growth of the informal economy reflects the failure of the formal economy to provide meaningful employment, and the fact that the working class are driven into the informal economy for survival, which is a common trend throughout Africa. Wage and salary rates at the upper levels of management continue to increase substantially and further widen the gap of inequality, but this is hardly complained about and never addressed. Reductions or freezing of high wages and salary rates can not only start with this high rate of inequality, but also freeze up money to be used for the lower income earners. The report states that the minimum wage, that a minimum wage result will be a rise in household income, particularly for low-income workers, with the threshold income growth potentially doubling, thus spurring greater consumer spending, and hence increased output and raise levels of growth together with rising productivity. But we don't agree with that, Chair. Because if the minimum wage is below the working poor, then this would not take effect. It must remember that the national minimum wage is not the same as a living wage, and that by its very nature, a national minimum wage falls short of providing workers with the means to live in human dignity, and that may still perpetuate the notion of the working poor. So that's the first issue. Then we just want to touch on the concept of a national minimum wage. And I think I was fortunate enough to sit in the earlier presentations, and I think some of them also addressed this thing. The notion of a minimum wage that is national is that it would cover all workers, specifically the lowest earners, throughout the country, thus providing uniformity and a base from which a worker can be ensured that entering the labour market in any sector, she/he can expect to be paid at the very least that minimum wage. This provides to the worker a sense of recognition, clarity, security, and the ability to budget. Now, this report that we spoke to, that we've referred to, also quotes the ILO, and you know we are member states to the International Labour Organization, I believe. Now, the report, the ILO is quoted as having a position that, and I quote, single national minimum wage is preferred by the ILO and minimum wage experts, and with minimum wage experts, because it covers all workers. It is easy to enforce and enjoys high compliance. Benefits all workers equally, can be said to serve broader policy objectives, such as the reduction of poverty and inequality, can be said to take account of workers' needs and macroeconomic growth. However, the bill excludes farm workers and domestic workers and workers in expanded works programs and workers who have concluded their learnership agreements, and such exclusions, what they do are the following. They fly in the face of the concept of it being a national, because now it does not apply to anyone. So we can't call this a national minimum wage. They undermine what is considered as a wage floor, as there would be different rates rather than a uniform one. They contravene the ILO position, as stated above, namely covering all workers. They can continue to perpetuate an injustice against an exploitation of farm workers, who are amongst the most vulnerable of our society. Farm workers who are treated as foreigners in even their own country and on their own land. Farm workers who, despite the advent of democracy, are still amongst the most exploited, even though they work the land and contribute to food security. And then they perpetuate gender discrimination. And here we talk specifically about domestic workers, the majority of whom are women, mothers, grandmothers, wives, sisters, children, whose contribution to society continues to be undervalued and who still work under poor working conditions. And we make reference to, and I think we should say that, we continue to sing the song My mother was a kitchen girl, and then we forget that we still perpetuate this by wanting to discriminate against them further. We also want to raise the issue around the issue about, when we speak about this one in particular, the domestic workers, we even questioning the fact that there's a constitutional issue here that we are busy with, because indirectly we are discriminating against women, and we feel that against females, so we think that is an issue that the committee should look at clearly. The exclusion of workers, again, this was raised earlier. In the expanded works program, it reflects poorly on government of the day. The programs are run by government are supposed to lead the way in the treatment and remuneration of people in its employ, especially since both policy and legislation, the very government promotes the eradication of such practices. Further, they are the ones, when one compares the wages and salaries of the public sector workers, the expanded work program rates are an embarrassment. Finally, such exclusions creates divisions within the working class and values, with some workers at the lower income being considered more than others. Then we want to just touch on the exclusion of certain sectorial determination rates, and this specifically refers again to the issue of the farm workers and domestic workers. From the national minimum wage, on the basis that they have their own sectorial determinations, contradicts the very purpose of a national minimum wage. It is almost as if such sectorial determinations have been introduced and cater for a special kind of worker, and their wage rates will increase eventually via such determination. And in our opinion, this doesn't make sense. There are at least 80 sectoral determinations, most of which focus on workers in sectors that render them vulnerable because of the nature of their work performed and the conditions they work under. To exclude farm workers and domestic workers only when they are covered by sectoral determinations, while other workers are covered by sectoral determinations, covered by are included, makes no sense. And we've listed there two examples, Chair, the hospitality and the security sector. Chair, then the next thing we want to deal with is the notion of a national maximum wage. I'm sure probably to a lot of questions from everybody, and I. But we want to speak about this because logically for us, if you speak about the national minimum wage, you speak about inequality, we have difficulty understanding how you are raising people at the bottom on a certain percentage, but you have no controls at the top. And, you know, so inequality just gets perpetuated without a national maximum wage. So we want this, you know, this is actually quite a serious suggestion that we want to make. It also talks, Chair, about the issue about the corruption that we have in our country, this disease of corruption, where and we talk about private and public sector, where people can earn any amount of money, you know, and they can steal it, then it's fine. But those at the bottom must suffer the consequences. So this issue of a national maximum wage might be laughed at, Chair, but I think if this committee is serious about inequality, just on the simple science of, you know, narrowing the gap between inequality, we can't just be dealing with one side of the equation and leaving the other side just to carry on unabated. So that is a serious one, Chair. We've listed there some statistics. Just on the last page, when we talk about 82%, Chair, that's actually wrong. It's actually 8,200% if we do our mathematics correctly, because we've spoken earlier in the submission about 80 times. 10% of full-time employees was 80 times the average of the bottom 10%. And as I said, that's part of the report. I don't want to go into the great detail, but just to say, Chair, that the issue of the national maximum wage is something that we are serious about. If we say the national maximum wage, the reasons why we say it commits all South Africans to addressing the issue of poverty and inequality, it frees up money at the top, which could then be used for those lower. It allows for the lower wage earners to increase their wages, effectively shorten the gap. And then what we've done is We've just recently, we've attached an article of doctors in Canada who had protested against the fact that their salaries were too high compared to other classes of people. And so, Chair, we're looking forward to seeing the members of this Parliament also thinking about maybe doing the same. Chair, I don't think that went down very well.
Hello, sir. We've done it in the past, so it's not
Okay, Chair. Oh, thank you very much, Chair. Then the issue of implementation and monitoring, Chair. One of the greatest weaknesses of all legislation, including the Constitution, is that of monitoring and implementation. And this is especially true when it comes to labor legislation. Despite all the laws that have been passed that create and create obligations, these laws seem to be broken just at the whim and fancy of employers. A national minimum wage can be destined for such ineffective outcome if there is no proper implementation. Monitoring of such implementation and taking action where violations occur is really necessary. So we're asking that the old system of the policing of the labor environment be looked at. Chair, we on this matter we can go into a whole lot of examples. We are cognizant of the fact that this committee has at stages went to factories to go and spotting investigations. We think that must be more of that, Chair. I think one of the things that you need to do is just go to your labor centers in the rural and peri-urban areas and just ask any one of those employees as they come out what was happening to them. In, you know, the issue about the rates that they get paid on, no pay slips, and the treatment the treatment that they get at the labor offices. In the 80s, Chair, if I can take you back, many of us were working in offices which were called advice offices, and we used to be the stop for workers between the Department of Labor. Workers didn't go to the Department of Labor, they came to advice offices because they did not trust the advice of the labor inspectors and the officials. They just didn't, and they were all white at that point in time, or mostly. I'm afraid, Chair, to say that if we don't look at this, we're going to have the same situation developing. The only thing is the colors of the inspectors are going to be different, but the actions are the same. So, I from outside, we're very serious about that, because a number of us have worked we're working in advice offices at that point in time. In conclusion, Chair, the Portfolio Committee on Labor must be emboldened by the decision and direction that the National Assembly has taken. Namely that on the expropriation of land without compensation. In this regard, the National Assembly has taken a step which defies the years of conservative speak that such action will destroy the economy and create social disharmony and insecurity and affect foreign investment. In the same manner, most of the arguments against a national minimum wage have been about unaffordability of employers, the drain for them on the company, how it will lead to greater unemployment, etc. These sentiments have persisted post-apartheid and have continued to ensure that for the past 24 years, fundamental changes that should have been implemented from 1994 are still not being implemented. This has resulted in the country having the invidious status of being one of the the most unequal society in the world, and that despite the majority of black people having suffered under apartheid, they continue to experience at times the same, if not worse, economic and social suffering. And our appeal, therefore, Chair, is that the portfolio must take bold steps, and we say this in relation to the bold step that has been taken around the issue of land, and we see this as even an easier step to take. And the portfolio must therefore take the bold step of changing the realities of the lowest paid workers by implementing a much higher minimum wage rate than 20 rand per hour. Include domestic, farm and expanded public works program workers in the national minimum wage ensure that all sectoral determinations are covered by this minimum wage, a national maximum wage to be discussed and investigation, and the implementation, monitoring, and imposing of sanctions relating to this and other legislation be strengthened and made effective. Thank you, Chair. That's our submission.
Thank you very much, Mr. Peterson. We appreciate your input. I'm making it open to for discussion. Honourable Bagarin.
Thank you, sir, for that input. Just a matter of interest, if you want to put a national maximum wage, I'm not sure how you're going to even introduce or set that. Sounds a bit absurd, but I mean, then an employer can't take deductions off the benefits that you would give. So you put a maximum wage, and then you give a whole lot of other benefits, such as shares and all sorts of other things. Don't you think that's a bit absurd to try and police that some way? Thank you.
Chair, with the issue around a maximum, a national, we haven't put a figure. If you really want us and you're going to take it seriously, that we can look at it. There is currently a national minimum wage. What we have said that, and I mean, I've explained the problem that we have. If we're going to get rid of inequality, we can't just be dealing with one side of the equation. And we are asking the committee to deliberate it and speak about it and see that. I don't know if everybody is opposed to it, but I think from where we're coming, we want this thing to be discussed. We want it to be form part of the national of the agenda and be part of the discussion. And I think this is part of the freedoms that we've been given to talk about those things. We knew that we would get responses that to say that it's absurd. But again, if we apply simple science, if you're talking about inequality, you can't get inequality if you're just going to eradicate inequality, if you're just going to deal with one part of the spectrum. And this is what the purpose of the bill is, to eradicate inequality. And we're asking, how are you going to do this? Let's not talk about this inequality. Let's take that part out of the bill. But if the drafters of the bill is clear about inequality, then you can't ignoring the other part of it. But Mr. Bagarin, we don't have a figure yet.
Thank you, sir. Honorable America.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Peterson, for the time and effort that you have put into your submission and being here today. And you mentioned that, it seems to me that you have deep passion for the vulnerable, and it's commendable. You speak about the farm workers and domestic employees and how they're excluded. They're not excluded. There are certain transitional arrangements for them to get to the national minimum wage as proposed. But I want to remind you that the Western Cape had the most severe drought in 100 years for the past 3 years. What you're proposing, and of course it has impacted quite negatively on our agricultural output. And do you think that the proposal that you suggest that we must have a higher minimum wage for those vulnerable workers, that it will not lead to greater job losses in our agricultural sector, that it will make our agricultural producers uncompetitive, that they are not price makers, they are price takers. And what seems to be getting in this whole debate is that we never ask ourselves the question, who do we compete with? Because the government has opted out of this particular process. by not paying the suggested 20 rand per hour, but they certainly want everybody else to buy into this 20 rand an hour. But we never ask ourselves, who do we compete with? Say, we're going to make our produce uncompetitive. It's going to drive people out of business. It is going to lead to greater job losses. So we need to find a balance where we recognize all the different variables and challenges that the South African economy is faced with, and that we don't aggravate the economic hardships that our people suffer. And it is often so, people say so glibly about inequality, they speak about inequality as if, you know, it's as a result of people being paid subagent wages. Inequality is, amongst others, of course, a direct result of 9.3 million people who are out of work. Families of 10, one person is working in the house, and six others are not working, and that one working individual has to support the family of 10. That brings about the poverty and the inequality that we have in the country. So we must be cautious if we don't take all of these things into consideration. It is not an either or, it is this and that. We must do this and we must do a lot of other things as well. And I want to conclude by a suggestion about national maximum wage. We compete with skills, and skills are not going to be compensated adequately. They're going to get fit, they're going to leave, and will contribute to higher inequality, will contribute to higher unemployment, and will make us, our organizations, less competitive. And those are the things that we need to consider. Just a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Honorable America. Do you want to? Honorable Seiko? Thanks, Chair. I can see on your attachment you have attached the Canadian unless they're attached by It's Not You, where the doctors were protesting against pay increase. However, we note your presentation. I've got a few questions on that one to say, if we want to bridge a gap ourselves, the inequality, the poverty that we're facing with as a country, how much yourself are you proposing? Because you just say we have proposed 20 rand. You haven't come up with a figure there. If they use how much, I think it will best suit what you're proposing. And this proposal of national maximum, I don't know what is it. Can you try and explain to us what is this maximum? The national maximum wage, so that we understand your point, because I feel this report is, you, for me, you are contradicting yourself, because you are saying and will cause problems, you are proposing more money on whatever we are proposing. So can you please address me there, so that I don't get more confused, because you can't say the country doesn't have money, we'll create more people with the unemployed, and then you're coming up with higher figures instead of the minimum what you are proposing ourselves. So can you please assist me there? I need some help here, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Teko. Sir, can you please respond to the question?
Chair, first, maybe with Mr. America's comment around the issue about the affordability and the issue around our markets. You know, Obviously, if that is a discussion that we need to go into, we can go into the details of that. But that's been a bogeyman for all over the years. All over the years, if you're going to increase wages. But what we've discovered is that, and I'm happy you mentioned the issue about the middle ground, because I think you are right. But what is happening currently is that right now, where this country started off much lower down in terms of the Gini coefficient, we are now the most unequal. So that tells me that the people on the top are getting much more of the cake than those at the bottom. And this is what's happening. So we have this society which is so, the gap is so wide. So I'm saying to you, yes, there must be a middle ground. And I'm substantiating this by looking at the issue of the corruption that's happening in the public sector, where billions can just fly on the stock exchange. And yet we're still sending our deciduous fruit to Europe. So as far as I'm concerned, where we sit in chair, we think that is not an argument. We think that the employers can afford more than that minimum. In fact, in the case of farm workers, I think it's about 15 rand. So just in terms of that, I mean, you know, I was going to say something that they say, the saying that says that slavery is not gone. We still have slavery. The only difference now is we pay out slaves. So that's also a comment from my side to you, Mr. Berry. The other lady, I wasn't too sure about the issue, the notion of a national minimum wage, maximum wage. As I said, we don't have a figure for a national maximum wage. We're wanting to introduce the notion. It's not discussed. There's a minimum wage which is part of a discussion. So you've got this 20 rand. We're saying discuss the other side, because if you want to get away with inequality, you can't have 20 on the one side and then you have a million on the other side, and then next week you have 2 million. You're not going to narrow that gap between equality. Chair, that's about the simplest way that I can explain that point.
Thank you, sir. What you also asked is in terms of the statement that you made that the 20 rand per hour should be increased. Do you have a figure in mind?
No, Chair. Again, as I said to you, when we had come, we didn't come here to negotiate, because in fact we don't have the power. We just want to express a view around that figure, and we use as references the living poor wages, those figures that are in that report we've attached, and we're saying that people can't live in a dignified way with those wages. That's what we're telling you.
That's noted. Thank you very much, Mr. Peterson, for giving or allowing us to interrogate you. And we surely take your what you said into consideration during our deliberation. We are then going to move to the CCMA, Mr. Morajani. Honourable members, can you come forward, Mr. Cameron? Honourable members, we have in our course pack, we have the CCMA presentation, but there has been another one distributed to us this morning. So can we use that one instead?
Thank you.
Are we all covered in terms of the presentation, honourable members? Members, it has been distributed this morning, so we'll just request Mrs. Akasa to send an electronic version to the members, those that doesn't seem to find it, so that we can move forward. Can we proceed in the meantime? Thank you. We give over to you, Mr. Murayami. You see, it's already starting on a rocker. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for offering us the 15-minute opportunity to come and make a presentation. Chairperson, for those who may have had the opportunity to see the presentation of the 15-minute, you would most probably note that our presentation in the main is a practical presentation. It's about practicality, one. Two, it is about clarification, also in support of the purpose of the legislature on what needs to be done, and also in the process attempting to make suggestions on how we think some of the clauses should be drafted, what should be there, because in the end, the CCMA will be expected to be the one that does the practical application of the outcomes of the three legislations. So our submission, Chairperson, that's why I'm saying it is a supportive one, that seeks to find a way to ensure that the proposed bills, all three, when they hit the streets, the moment it becomes an act of parliament, there shouldn't be things that makes it impossible for the minimum wage to be implemented. Because if you look at the purpose of the bill in the preamble, it will show you that the CCMA is receiving a lot as far as the new jurisdiction is concerned. So all we can do as an institution of statutory creation is to apply our mind on what the legislature wants to do and try to help and see what is practical and what is not. That's the whole, in the main, the practical application of our submission. Chapter 10, in assisting, we have started with a background which we just touch on certain important aspects because we feel that it will be important that background be understood in the context of to what is being proposed. And then we will then proceed to deal with the specific general commentaries that we make in as far as the bills are concerned. And then finally we will deal with the specific sections without actually drafting it, but raising the issue on what the problem is with those specific. We will assist the members to take them through those specific provisions. In the future, if the committee accepts the suggestions and proposals that the CCMA is making, we have also taken the liberty together with the Department of Labour to make the actual drafting of the specific clauses that we feel, if accepted, how they should look like. Also just to assist to the extent that it may be possible. So that's the scope of our presentation. In the background, Chairperson, as I've already indicated, that the CCMA is an institution that is created by an act of parliament. In the main, the parent legislation that creates the CCMA is the Labour Relations Act, in terms of section 112 to section 126. And in that process, it includes the main thing, which being the dispute resolution, where we can't resolve a dispute, then we find a way to manage a dispute, and in the process also do what we call institution building. This is due through our trainings and advocacy campaigns, the same way we're doing currently with the current bills, that we take it that it is our responsibility, because of who we are, to ensure that the labour market is properly educated and informed about what the purpose of these amendments are. And that's part of institution building, which includes the Parliament Council. Proceeding there, the mandate of the CCMA is not just limited to the Labour Relations Act. We also get our power from the Employment Equity Act, and also, as amended, the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. So moving forward, Chairperson, the expanded jurisdiction of the CCMA is no longer just limited to other than the Employment Equity Act. It now includes the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, which is, in fact, the execution tool of the minimum wage. And it is therefore proposed, Chairperson, in our view, that moving forward, for the minimum wage to be practicalized and to be understood perfectly, and how exactly it's going to be protected and how it's going to be implemented, it is highly recommended that anyone who reads the minimum wage must read it together with the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, because the Basic Conditions of Employment Act is joined in the hip with the minimum wage bill. So these two, in terms of interpretation application, cannot be separated. Now, Chairperson, having said so, it is important to note, in as far as the background is concerned, that the existence of the CCMA in the past 20 years has seen a remarkable growth in as far as dispute resolution is concerned. You may note that the CCMA, in actual fact, in the past 20 years, we have received more than 2.7 million referrals to the CCMA, and approximately 800,000 arbitrations, and 1.8 million conciliations, and an estimated 1.7 million cases were heard. In the previous financial year alone, the CCMA received approximately 180,000 referrals. And I might add, Chairperson, that as we sit now, we are close to 190,000, and we anticipate that by the end of the current financial year, the CCMA will be sitting at 200,000 plus cases referred. And this must be noted, Chairperson, that this figure I am giving is a figure that does not involve the new jurisdiction that we're expecting to start on the 1st of May 2018. So I will deal with that also as far as the increase is concerned. So 95.1% of these disputes referred were actually in terms of the Labour Relations Act, 3% referred in terms of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. And you will note, Chairperson, as you mentioned, that 3% that actually lastly, it had to do with Section 41, which had to do with the severance pay of employees, which is linked to the Section 189, which is a dismissal based on operational requirements, commonly known as retrenchment or a dismissal without fault on the part of the employee. Now, we therefore, based on what is proposed in the minimum wage, together with the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, we'll expect that the caseloads, and as far as the basic conditions is concerned, will increase, because any referral of dispute as proposed can only be done through the Basic Conditions of Employment Act as amended. On average, therefore, I would share the CCMA caseload increases before where we're at now by 5% year on year. You will note that below the presentation that the figures will change because of our focus based on the introduction of the minimum wage set together with the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. The CCMA, therefore, Chairperson, carries out its functions through the appointment of suitably qualified skilled part-time and full-time commissioners. Our part-time commissioners are seen as the independent contractors, and for us to execute our function with the commission, we're using both the full-time and the part-time commissioners. This excludes other full-time staff, case management officers, and the rest of the crew that supports the function of both our commissions. So the CCMA powers are therefore derived directly from the LRA as I presented, while in support of that, which is important, which we'll deal with also as part of this presentation, we always say that if you come to a house, it's important to understand our rules. And the governing body of the CCMI, through its tripartite structure, drafts these rules for publication and publication on how we deal with matters of the CCMI. The chairperson will also note, as we progress in our presentation, that there's also going to be proposed certain legislative changes we request, because these changes in legislation will enable the governing body to be able to make specific rules that will accommodate the new jurisdiction as expanded by the proposed bills. Now, it is therefore based on those three legislation changes that our submission is based on. If I proceed to page 3, the intended effect of the proposed amendment is to minimize the incidence of strike-related violence, to reposition the labor market's approach to dealing with collective bargaining matters, to introduce a national minimum wage, and which now the next part affects us, which is the expansion of the CCMI jurisdiction. You will note that quite explicitly in the preamble of the basic conditions. Now, the short to long-term benefits of the proposed amendments would be to promote economic development and advance labor market peace and stability with the CCMA seen as the vehicle to implement and execute these changes. Jefferson, if you look at the economic development aspect that we just talked about and the labor market stability issues, these are the matters you'll find in Chapter 1 of the Labor Relations Act. So this also enforces the purpose and objectives of the Labor Relations Act as the parent legislation, that the execution of these amendments is intended to support those. So it is definitely in line with the purpose and also in terms of the Constitution. Honourable Chair, I will elaborate more on the part that deals with what we call the execution, which is quite important in terms of enforcement. Let me proceed. Therefore, it is anticipated that the implementation of these amendments on collective bargaining, minimum wage and basic conditions will definitely have a significant impact on the CCMI operations, resulting in increase in caseload and non-statutory processes. Chairperson, the committee must note that there's no doubt in our mind, and anyone who understands the operation of the CCMI, that the expanded jurisdiction as we see it will definitely have not just an impact, a significant impact to the CCMA. And I can confirm, Honourable Chair, that the impact we're talking about is going to have a serious resource challenge to the CCMA as it is now. Now, proceeding, while the CCMA fully appreciates the significance of the proposed amendment, there is a concern regarding the availability of adequate resources to meet expected service delivery in respect thereof. Chairperson, let me explain. When it comes to the service delivery question, it must be understood that as the CCMA, we take pride in that we are giving this important function of ensuring that we meet the four corners of service delivery. Because if the minimum wage were to see the light of day, we are expecting that there will be cases of non-committal. There will be cases of non-application of the minimum wage. And the CCMA, as part of the process of the enforcement process, is expected to ensure that it is being implemented. And if it is implemented accordingly, it does contribute directly to the triple crisis in terms of ensuring that that which the legislature intends to do, it is being done. But in the absence of adequate resources, that might be a bit difficult. So we're asking that the committee note that, as far as resources are concerned in terms of operations, finances, and also the human resources where you find the commissioners, it is quite an important concern. I must acknowledge that it was raised back in last time when we presented the minimum wage, that this aspect that we're talking about for resources, it is a matter of great concern. And it has to continue to be able to realize the implementation of this important historical introduction. The proposed amendment, therefore, Chairperson, will result in that increased wage-related disputes, additional collective bargaining support processes such as pre- and post-wage facilitations, establishment of workplace participatory structures and balloting exercise. From the closed chapters, these processes are just proposed. The post-wage facilitation, the pre-wage facilitation, the establishment of all the structures. These are the systemic innovations that are intended to ensure that when it comes to the purposes of the Act, especially when it comes to collective bargaining, that it is realized. It is created with an intention to support the CCMA benefit from the procedure, Chair. The CCMA on average received 4,600 mutual interest, meaning potentially stipulated letters per annum. And the consequences of the proposed change will at the very least translate into a 30% hike in cases or processes associated with the specific changes in our focus. So that's the reality, the focus that we're raising. And we're raising this picture so that the committee can take note of this potential challenge that we're facing and seeking assistance and support that we're receiving from the Department of Labor. On the other hand, the amendments contemplated in the basic conditions, read together with the minimum wage, will increase the CCMA current caseload by an anticipated 15%. This is in addition to the annual caseload increase of partners, as I explained earlier. Therefore, when we're talking about operational and resource needs, it is based on these actuals and predictions that we've just presented. Now, Chairperson, that concludes the background part. Now, I want to make certain important comments, general comments as far as the Act, the legislation are concerned. If you proceed to page 4, we submit that the enactment of provisions relating to the basic conditions of the national minimum wage will have a number of consequences for the CCMA, which will result in novel processes, which include 1, labor inspectors and other representatives of the Department of Labor being entitled to refer cases involving undertakings to pay and compliance costs. If I may pause just slightly, Chairperson, when it comes to the labor inspectors, it's important that we make it very clear, and at least I must clearly explain, because I've seen it in some of the publications, some of the comments that are made in public, and I want to correct it here. Labor inspectors, as we know them, will not be reporting as employees to the CCMA. They remain where they are at. Nothing has changed. It's nowhere stated here, but I'm dealing with it in this committee because it's the place to clarify it. That the changes that have occurred, it does not change the vocation of the labor inspector. They remain where they are at. Inspection services in the Department of Labor. That doesn't change. All that the bill makes reference to that labor inspectors have the right to refer cases to the CCMA, where you have the undertakings and the compliance orders that are referred to the CCMA, but not that the CCMA is taking over the inspection function. The inspection functions of the Department of Labor remain where they are at. That has not changed. I am not in any way, Jefferson, just suggesting that this committee has said so, but it is because of the things that we've read and the sessions we've attended where these suggestions have been made. We just thought it was important that it be clarified. The further impact, Jefferson, that the consequence we're talking about is that employers being entitled to refer objections to compliance orders to the CCMA in terms of the amended Section 69. In the previous legislation, we did have employers always having the opportunity to raise objections to the compliance orders that are raised by the inspector. And that opportunity is still there in the bill, where such objections will be raised with the CCMA, and I will deal with that later in terms of Section 73 at the bottom. Now, workers who fall outside of the definition of employee in terms of the Labor Relations Act and Basic Constitutional Employment Act will be entitled to refer claims to the CCMA to enforce the national minimum. I shall deal with this later as well. Now, having said so, Honourable Chair, the CCMA will have, in terms of the proposed Section 73, Capital A, a general jurisdiction to arbitrate on claims for underpayment arising out of the legislation we're talking about, collective bargaining, contracts for employees earning below the threshold, which is in terms of Section 6, Subsection 3 of the Basic Conditions. and is published from time to time by the Minister of Labour. As indicated above, the CCMA operates in terms of a detailed set of rules, which are implemented in terms of Section 115 of the Labour Relations Act. These rules are adopted, as I said, by the governing body of the CCMA. The CCMA therefore requests that the amendments include a provision which confirms that the governing body of the CCMA has the power to make rules and regulations in newly anticipated proceedings. These rules should be able to apply existing rules and provisions of the LMA to these proceedings. Chairperson, let me try to simplify this provision further. What this actually says is that what we have, I will deal with it at the later stage, but just to clarify what you just explained, is that the CCMA is unable to make any rule unless empowered by legislation. And the power to make rules as matters stand, it is only provided for in the Labour Relations Act. The proposed Basic Conditions of Employment Act and the Minimum Wage does not make such a provision, which gives us the power to amend rules to accommodate the new changes. For safety's sake, and for ensuring that we exclude possible unnecessary, complicated and protracted legislations, we are proposing that there should either be in the Minimum Wage Act, preferably in the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, that a specific insertion be made that says the CCMA governing body does have the power to make rules that support the proposed legislation to enable us to do so as the governing body of the CCMA. One of the ways of doing so is to make reference to Labour Relations Act that the CCMA can make further rules to accommodate that in terms of the current Labour Relations Act. That will enable us or give us the power to do so. Because that's the type of battle legal if you don't want to engage in, because it's time wasting and it's wasting money. And further to the chairperson, our understanding is that the provisions that I'm talking about were in an earlier draft which was proposed at NEDLAC, which was in terms of Section 146, capital A to C. But when the bill was published, those provisions were not there. So it might assist if we proceed and look at those specific provisions and see if we have to relook at them, which will give us a bit of muscle to be able to create rules that are in line with that. In therefore concluding on the general comments, Chairperson, an appropriate provision to enable the system to make those rules relating all those matters is therefore proposed that it should be included either in the Labour Relations Act Bill or the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. In this regard, it is further noted that the DG of Labour will be required to delegate or assign the functions of appearing in proceedings before the CCMA or the Labour Court arising out of the enforcement of the National Minimum Wage. The Basic Conditions of Employment Act, and interestingly, the unemployment insurance legislation is also added into the equation. What this means, Chairperson, where we are asking that the appropriate amendment be made to Section 85, Subsection 5, it is because that the current bill does make provision that those that can appear before the CCMA in terms of the new jurisdiction, in terms of Section 73, it is the labor inspector. But in our process of ensuring that we understood what this means, we approached the Department of Labor Inspections in particular and asked specifically who exactly is appearing at the labor court before this new jurisdiction comes to the CCMA. We were advised that statutory agents or someone like that who are part of the inspection service are the ones that appear in matters of this nature. So the practicality of that is presenting that specific problem, that the bill talks about the inspectors who must appear, yet the practice and somebody else who appears. We do not want to incur a complication like that. So that's why therefore there's this proposal that in terms of what the DG can delegate, that provision be reviewed, which we will deal with at a later stage, which is not limited to the inspectors. Chairperson, let me go to the meat of the matter, which is now the direct section. And I'm starting on paragraph 3.2, which is on page 5. Let me start with section 68 of the Basic Conditions of Employment. Section 68 allows labor inspectors to secure written undertakings from the employers to comply with any provisions of the Basic Conditions. The proposed amendment will extend this power to the National Minimum Wage Act and the unemployment legislation, which is the contributions and the UI Act. In addition, the power to enforce the scheme undertaking which is not compliant is to be transferred from Labour Court to the CCMA. The CCMA supports this amendment, has no comments in the specific wording of the provision. Let me just pause, Chairperson, and explain. There's been some debate in some quarters about what execution or enforcement means. And I want to present how we understand it. The process of enforcement is not limited to when the inspector issues an undertaking or when it issues a compliance order. The CCMA's role in terms of expanded jurisdiction is that we will receive a referral from the Director General saying that here is a compliance order, an undertaking that was done between the employer and the employee, and the employer has failed to implement. And that will be a request to the CCMA to issue an arbitration award, which is what we are doing now normally in terms of our cases. So our duty as the CCMA in issuing that award, it is part of that process of enforcement. But let me explain more clarity here, because I know that some of the members of the committee may not be privy to how it practically works. Is that once the award is issued, therefore there are three main players. The first player, it is the inspector who issues the compliance order. In an ideal world, where it is expected that when an inspector issues a compliance order, it is expected that the content of that compliance order must be implemented by the employer. As it normally happens, it doesn't. So the current practice now is that the inspector or the Department of Labor, together with the DG, will then refer the non-compliance to the Labor Court. Now, in terms of the proposed bill, that function of referral no longer goes to the Labor Court, but it comes to the CCMA. So that's the first part. So now the second part is where the CCMA comes in instead of the court as it used to be. That's the second part of enforcement. The third part, which is the most important one, which is creating a lot of confusion, is what then happens after the award is issued, because you're still going to get persons who do not even implement. This is the last arm. The last arm of that, it proceeds to the shelf. It is not the CCMA that takes the award, goes to the employer's places, and gets the employer to do what is supposed to be done in terms of the arbitration award. What we do, and to the extent to which we only go, is issuing the arbitration award. What comes afterwards is the still non-compliance. The shelf must execute. So it is those different arms and phases of execution. So when we talk in the practice of the CCMA in terms of enforcement, it must be understood in that context. Let me proceed to this. Now, here's an important provision, which is Section 69 of the Basic Conditions. Section 69 deals with the issue of compliance orders by labor inspectors. The changes that are introduced will extend this power to the National Minimum Wage Act and the unemployment legislation in the same manner as in Section 69. That I've just talked about. The current system, in terms of which employers may make representations concerning compliance up to the DG, is replaced by giving employers a right to lodge an objection to compliance order with the CCMA. Let me pause. They used to do exactly that as it happens now. If an employer has a problem with a compliance order, there was an old Section 6271, but now currently it applies objections raised to the DG. This function of objection is now transferred to the CCMA, because in case of non-compliance, now we issue the arbitration awards, the objections are now lodged with the CCMA instead of the DG. I will explain it, but there's a provision that deals with that. Therefore, having said so, Honourable Chair, the CCMA supports the introduction of this new approach. And at the same time, it knows that the bill should provide sufficient clarity concerning the process for referral and time periods for the referral, because that's where the gap comes in. The CCMA further notes that the bill does not deal with the issue of whether an employer should be able to apply for condemnation for late referral. Let me explain. In any processes before the Commission, there are prescribed rules and time periods within which things must be done. Therefore, if it so happens that the employer is late in lodging the objections. In the normal course, there's a provision made for a condemnation application. But under the current circumstances, we do not have such a provision, which disempowers us. So that's why we're proposing that there should be a consideration legislative that the provision be made. In the event the employer is late in lodging an objection after the 14 days of the compliance order, that they can be able to raise such an objection, but give reasons why they are late. And there's a further proposition to that, if I may proceed. In general terms, Chair, the CCMA rules provide that condemnation for late referrals are permitted on good cause shown. While this does allow cases where there is good reason for the delay, it can result in situations in which the condemnation provisions are abused for the purpose of delaying dispute resolution, which seems is now dealing with matter cases. Accordingly, the CCMA would be supportive of the inclusion of an appropriately worded condemnation provision, providing that an employer seeking condemnation for late referral is required to furnish security to the satisfaction of the CCMA in respect of the amount that must be paid in terms of the compliance order. In this regard, it is pointed out that, and proceeding out to present to page 6 at the bottom, at the top, that an equivalent provision in respect of the review proceedings against arbitration awards was introduced by the RFA in terms of section 145.7. Let me explain to you. In terms of the labor relations as it stands, if you are bringing a review against a party, you are expected to provide security so that in the end, if you are not able to proceed with your review, there's at least the security that you will be able to meet the obligations contained in the award. We are taking the same provision as applying in terms of section 145, subsection 7, reintroducing it into the minimum wage. The reason why we're doing it is that we have an appreciation of the category of people that we're talking about. And if you're talking about people who are below the threshold that is set, it tells you that you're dealing with the most vulnerable. One of the things they can't afford is some protracted delay based on this type of objection and ending up with the matter not happening. So if you feel strongly that you've got a material issue to raise against a compliance order, then provide security as provided for the Labour Relations Act so that whatever happens in your objection, the employee does not suffer the consequence of not having a compliance order satisfied. And a compliance order only means paying what is due to. And usually, it's not a huge amount. So we can't allow a scenario where such a process, which is intended to be simplified, if you read the brief quite carefully, it's intending to make the process of enforcement very simple, very inexpensive, and very quick. And one of the things that can offend it is these objections that we just introduced willingly and frustrating the applicant. So therefore, it is proposed that such a security be considered by this committee, that there should be that specific protection. It is further pointed out that the chairperson, this is something that we feel should be looked at because there's some incorrect reference to the proposed Section 73. There was a reference to Section 69.6 and Section 73.6. Which we propose that it be re-looked at because we don't think that provision is actually required. Let me proceed, Chairperson. Now, in relation to Section 69, we propose that the provision should provide that commissioner who hear an objection that I just spoke about in terms of Section 69 should have the power to issue an arbitration award that confirm, vary, or set aside the compliance order. These are my 69, Chairperson. That the power that we currently enjoy in terms of the Labour Relations Act is that when rulings are made, especially when there's been errors that were made, that we do have the power to vary and set aside certain rulings. And this we do through decisions, for example. Now, in the event like we have now, when these compliance orders and undertakings are referred to the Commission, if there are such errors, we don't have that stands now to do exactly that. So we are asking that a similar power that we enjoy, as far as the LNA is concerned, that we should have the power to vary or confirm the compliance order as referred to us by labor inspectors or whoever is so delegated by the Director General. Now, for the sake of clarity, we point out that such an award, as well as any other award arising out of the proposed amendment, may be reviewed under the relevant provisions of the Labour Relations Act in the same manner as any other award issued pursuant to the provisions of the Labour Relations Act. As indicated, it will be necessary for the governing body of the CCMA to have appropriate powers to make such rules. Chairperson, let me explain. You see, the Employment Attitude Act makes provision for an appeal. The Labour Relations Act, in terms of our award, if there's a defect, it makes provision for a review. And the awards that we're issuing are also subject to that. There's no difference. There was a proposition that the awards that we issue in relation to pay disputes relating to the Basic Conditions of Employment Act must be subject to an appeal. But there's a problem with that. If we introduce such, it will create a serious confusion as well, because it is the same institution called the CCMA, in terms of the Labour Relations Act, that is subjected to an award which is subject to a review. And now, if we introduce the same for the purposes of the pay dispute, it means that people can attack the content, not just the process. For consistency purposes, and because of the simplicity of the matter that we're talking about, we want to keep it at reviews like all other awards, with the exception of the Employment Equity Act. Now, proceeding to a very serious clause, which is Section 73, which is the one that really gives us the jurisdiction. The proposed amendment to Section 73 will have the effect of transferring the power to confirm the compliance order from the Labour Court to the CCMA. This is a big change. This is the biggest change of the basic conditions. As indicated, the CCMA supports this amendment, subject to the proposed changes suggested below. One, in order to appreciate the significance of Section 73, it is necessary to read it in conjunction with Section 69 of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. Section 69 actually allows an employer who disputes a compliance order issued by a labor inspector to lodge an objection, which will be adjudicated now by the Commission of the CCMA. In this context, Section 73 is applicable to instances in which an employer has neither complied with nor objected to a compliance order. In such a case, the CCMA's function is to confirm the compliance order and give it the status of an arbitration award. Accordingly, it is proposed that the CCMA should be able to issue an arbitration award if it is satisfied that the compliance order was served on the employer and the employer has not referred an objection relating to the compliance order. If these requirements are not satisfied, the award cannot be issued. Accordingly, we understand Section 73 to involve a limited inquiry as to whether or not a compliance order that has not been complied with should be given the status of an arbitration order so that it can be enforced. Let me explain, Chairperson. In as far as this provision is concerned, our view is very simple here, that there is a provision that is made where we make the compliance order to be an award. What we don't want to see is to have a protracted, complicated process, because all that is happening here is that the DG is requesting the CCMA to make a compliance order to be an award, not starting an inquiry afresh. That's never the purpose. That's never the plan. What is missing from the bill is exactly what I said, that in ensuring that the award that we issue is not issued without the employer knowing, there has to be an addition that shows that the same compliance order has been issued to the employee and has been issued to the employer. So everyone is affected by it. They are aware of its existence. They are aware of its content. So that if there is no compliance with that and there is no objection, the CCMA should be able to proceed to issue an arbitration award, which is what we want to cater for in our case management system without any complication. We do have a similar process, as we understand, Chairperson. We do have requests to convert settlement agreements into arbitration awards, and we've never had to have any inquiry in between to do so, because the evidence portion of that process and anything relating to it has been done. Ours is to close it with the necessary teeth to make sure that it is applicable. We want to extend the same teeth to these awards that we issue that have to do with the minimum wage. Ours is to ensure that it is enforced using those agencies not have explained earlier. Chairperson, the CCMA also is of the view that section 73 subsection 1 is appropriately drafted. However, it requests that the committee to consider amendment to section 73(2) to reflect these explanations that I've just given in terms of the notification and things like that, to make sure that the request that we get from the DG to the CCMA to issue an award in terms of section 73 is done that fair. In fact, what we thought about, which we will raise, but without really pushing too much into it, if you look at section 73 as proposed, it says that the DG must bring an application. But we believe that it's not really an application, it's just a request. If you use the word application in the context of the CCMA, it brings other processes of affidavits and all of that. We don't think it is necessary. Given the people that we serve and the level of people that we serve, the less complicated the process, the better. So bringing applications, attaching affidavits, going to the police and courts and asking for them to be commissioned, many of the people that are covered by this provision, I do not think that we should be subjecting them to those kinds of applications. Now, there's also a submission made, Chairperson, that there's a reference to representations in terms of Section 73(2). Those representations, in our view, are not necessary because that is covered in terms of Section 69 already. It is further submitted due to the fact that the role of the system is confined to confirming or setting aside the compliance order, the matters dealt with in those paragraphs A to D are not required, as these items will be addressed in the compliance order. If you specifically look at section 69, chapter, 73, sorry, that deals with A to D, those items that are mentioned there, you know, the compliance with employment law, the amount that must be paid, the penalties, those things are actually catered for in the compliance order. So there's no need to repeat that in terms of section 73. That's our view. We are willing to be persuaded. Now, another important, very important provision is section 73, letter A. This provision claims an employee with a claim for underpayment in terms of either the basic conditions, the sectoral determination. And when we're referring to sectoral determination, Chairperson, we're referring to the sectoral determination that is already issued, because in terms of the current proposed bill, there will be no sectoral determination that are issued after the bill comes or becomes an act. They end on the date of gazetting. But we still have sectoral determinations that are existing currently that would have been issued prior to the enactment of the minimum wage. And therefore, we are saying, therefore, in relation to the collective and the contract of employment is required to institute proceedings. The labor court's concurrent jurisdiction in respect of these claims is confirmed in terms of section 77, subsection 3 of the basic condition. If I may explain to this, especially which will cover the second two paragraphs as well. Currently, when an employee has an outstanding leave pay, and such payment that have not been implemented, they go to the Department of Labor. The only time that the CCMA will deal with such claims is when such claims are brought together and joined with an unfair dismissal claim. The purpose, therefore, of the introduction of Section 73A is to create a divorce between the two, that you can bring a pay dispute directly to the CCMA, which is unmerited to the consolidated proceedings in terms of Section 37 of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. Now, what we then propose, that if you look at paragraph 3, it says the CCMA understands that the purpose of the proposed inclusion of Section 73 claim is to allow underpayment claims by low-paid employees, those earning below the threshold, to be instituted in the CCMA, in addition to the courts. The CCMA welcomes this amendment and makes the following comment. Let me explain if I do the comment section, because that's the twist of what you're about to submit, is that pay disputes have been referred jurisdictionally to the CCMA. It is exactly the simplification that the legislation is trying to do. So So effectively, after the minimum wage is introduced and the basic conditions changes have been welcomed, that simplifies the process. That's the whole purpose of this amendment. Now, as a result of that, we make this following suggestion, which I will explain. Section 73A, therefore, requires a technical redrafting, as we say, to clarify its terms. In addition, the CCMA is of the view that the majority of claims that will arise from Section 73A can be resolved in a single event involving conciliations, and if this does not resolve the matter, arbitrations. Section 73A should be amended to include such a provision. It is noted, Chapter 10, that the version of the LRA amendment be approved by NADEC parties included such a provision, but is not in the published one. Now, let me explain this, Chapter 10. In terms of the 2015 LRA amendment, there was an inclusion of what is called the CONAP. The idea of the CONAP, as it was introduced then, it was intended that those who, when a referral is made, and for the purpose of expedition, that you do a CONAP, and immediately afterwards you do an arbitration. The idea of such an amendment was to make sure that there are no inordinate delays in the matters appearing before the CCMA and the Parliament Council. There was therefore a proposal that an objection that is raised against the CONAP must allow the objector to satisfy certain requirements while they're objecting. But that never found itself into the amendment. What then has happened now in practice is that people just object and they don't have to give reasons, as matters stand. So somebody can just add one or two words, I object, and that's when it separates the conciliation process from the arbitration. The whole idea why the legislature, this house, made that change, it was to ensure that the conciliation and arbitration run together immediately after the other in order to expedite the resolution of the dispute, which is the real purpose of the Labour Relations Act. Now, in terms of Section 73A, which is really a pay dispute in the category that we've explained, if then we adopt the same approach that if someone has a pay dispute, must go to conciliation, then after conciliation, 90 days and the fair arbitration, it's defeating the purpose of expedition. What we want to introduce and propose is that in terms of this section, that a CONAP be reintroduced, but without the right to object. So if you refer conciliations, you will proceed to arbitration immediately afterwards, without the power to make an objection. If you have a problem in dealing with the matter for whatever the reason, you shall have to bring appropriately, in terms of our rules, an application for postponement. But the idea, given the amount of money we're talking about and the level of employees we're talking about, our view that social justice will be affected if there is no such a provision that is made, if you can just make an objection. So the CCMA therefore knows it will be undesirable if matters that have already been dealt with in terms of Section 64, 69, and 73 are raised again in terms of this provision, which is Section 73A, and proposes that a provision to that effect be included in terms of Section 73. Now, finally, that concludes the submissions in terms of the basic conditions and the minimum wage. There's only one provision that we feel strongly about in terms of the Labour Relations Act. In particular, this is Section 127, Subsection 1. These chapters I can talk to without even making specific reference. Now, because it relates to Section 1. What this is, what we are actually doing in this proposal is a balancing act. One of the things that we've experienced as the Commission is that we have had a number of cases as well where there has been what we call unnecessary litigation. Now, the one principle of statutory drafting that we believe is that the legislature, when it makes provision, the expected approach is that that which the legislature intends is expressed clearly in writing. What you find in the current section is that the CCMA, as it stands in terms of that section, we have the power to accredit bargaining councils and also the panelists that appear in those bargaining councils. Now, we have had challenges where P people challenge the power of the CCMA not to accredit, but whether we can remove the accreditation that we have given. Because there is no extra provision that you find in that specific section or the entire LSA that gives the CCMA the power to remove or withdraw the accreditation that we have given to a council and also to a panelist. So the proposal here for clarity, certainty, and good drafting, we are proposing that the power to withdraw the accreditation that we have given, which we have in terms of law, it must make a clear provision as well that the CCMA does have the power to withdraw that accreditation. There is an interpretation that exists, and correctly so to a certain extent, that if you have the power to accredit, if you interpret it properly, it says that you have the power to withdraw. But that has exposed us to unnecessary litigation, where matters get delayed and people argue that we don't have the power to do so while reading into it. We are therefore asking this committee to consider, therefore, introducing a provision. In fact, you do have a similar provision that you find in the minimum wage bill itself, because it does tell you that the appointment of the 13 members into the commission, the minimum wage commission, it tells you that who has the power to do so, but it does tell you exactly also how the power is moved and how the appointment or disappointment is made. There's clarity in terms of the bill, but we don't have a similar clarity when it comes to the Labour Relations Act. We believe, therefore, Chairperson, as I conclude, that this express power to the CCMA should be legislated, which is a balancing provision to the power to accredit. Chairperson, that concludes the submissions of the CCMA to the basic conditions, minimum wage, and also the LLA. The rest of the provisions in the LLA has assisted us in terms of what is included now, so we have no further comment other than this one that we just made, which concludes the presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Morajani. Surely also insightful the new proposals that you are making, and also clearly for us to look into. Can I open it for discussion, Honourable Members? Honourable Begram, first Honourable America, then Honourable Begram.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did I have a jail-free card if my colleague speaks first?
Can we have volume, please, Honourable America?
My apologies. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was saying that I was hoping to get a get out of jail card free if my colleague speaks before me, because he wants to obviously all the things I wanted to say. Thank you.
That's why I'm giving you preference this time.
So I'm going to be brief. I was saying that on page 4, the top C, the enactment of provisions relating to the BCA and national minimum wage will have a number of consequences for these human rights on blah blah blah. That's good. Number C, it says workers who fall outside of the definition of the employee in terms of the LRA and the BCA will be entitled to refer claims to the CCMA to enforce the national minimum wage. Can you provide, I have missed your further explanation with regard to that one, because we had a submission earlier from Fishing South Africa, and they expressly stated that some of their members fall outside of national minimum wage in the sense that they are not classified as an employee in terms of the BCA. I'm just a little confused now, because frankly speaking, I can't think of any person other than, you know, the National Defence Force people who fall outside of this particular process. Yeah. Secondly, On the following page, page 5, that I'm happy that you have emphasized the absence of provisions within the legislation to enable people to apply for condemnation, because certainly that's been a shortcoming, and it needs to be clarified so that we know under what circumstances people could apply for condemnation. Following page, in page 6, amendments to section 73. Now there I need some clarity in terms of the compliance orders that referral and objections to compliance orders. Now is that process going to take place in the form of a conciliation? Is it going to be done in the papers, or is it going to be just an arbitration process that's going to be effected? Some clarity on that particular one. And Madam Chair, will leave the rest to my colleagues. Thank you.
Honourable Baker, thank you, Honourable America.
Thank you, Honourable America. That's very good of you. Madam Chair, thanks. Mr. Mariani, thank you for what is actually very enlightening to me, because when I read it bold, I didn't fully understand it, so maybe I haven't read it all that carefully, but thank you. I do have some questions, obviously in general, some more specific, but you said up front that you're possibly expecting a 15% increase in your caseload. I beg to differ, and I don't know where you got that 15% from, but I had suggested to you on a previous occasion in this committee that I think it's going to double, so I think your 15% is very conservative, and I very strongly, and I said that when the DG was here, very strongly believe that you've actually taken on not only an increase in caseload, but a lot of the cases will go to the Labour Court. And I'm thinking that you should be asking for a double figure of your increased budget. So I just wanted to actually make that point, because, and especially in the beginning, you've got to start training and capacitating and actually using commissioners, and I actually think you're going to need double the amount of commissioners, which also begs the question, your commissioners who are part-time and no longer, they're going to be seen as permanent employees. I've always thought they were anyway, including your interpreters, but that's our personal argument. But they are permanent employees, and especially under this. I just want to pick up from where my colleague left off about workers who fall outside the definition of employee. That means everyone who does any work in South Africa, regardless of whether they're independent contractors or whether they work for themselves, anyone can come and start looking for compliance orders. I find that absurd, absolutely absurd. And maybe you can comment on what you think about that. But the plumber that comes to my house, because I've got a very bad leaking system in my house, that plumber could possibly come to the CCMA or to an inspector to get a compliance audit. Do you think that would be correct? I mean, that to me sounds like the Alice in Wonderland, someone who pays himself. These claims in terms of 73A underpayments, the legislation, that's all underpayments. That's not just the national minimum wage. My understanding of it, it's all underpayments. So if someone didn't pay me my proper leave pay, I can now come directly to you. I don't have to go to the Department of Labor, but it would be anyone that could have any claim of any nature of an underpayment, and it doesn't even have to be an employee. I'm not sure why we'll even need a small claims court if that's the case. They can all come to you. It's a nice red carpet leading down to the CCMA. I think you must change your name as well to the Commission for Compensation Mediation and Arbitration, as opposed to the CCMA. It's like a big ATM down at South Bank. And I'm saying that a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but there's a lot of truth to that as well. I do agree with you that the set of rules become all important. The devil is in the detail. And maybe you can comment a little bit on that, but I strongly believe that the rules are going to make this workable. Because as you know, without those complicated rules of conciliation, mediation, arbitration, things fall apart, and that was the way you've been able to smooth run the hundreds of thousands of cases that come through your doors, and these are going to double. So yes, I would strongly support your governing body getting the power to put together these rules. Just in terms of the appearance, note that the Director General of Labour will be required to delegate or assign the function of appearing and proceeding before the CCMA or the Labour Court, arising out of the enforcement. That's appearance. I suppose you could handle that through rules as well. It might not have to be done through legislation, because you don't want to make the legislation too complicated either. Young law students won't be that keen to study labour law if you start putting the rules in the law. It would be terrible. But those officials will then be able to appear. Once you've opened up that door, it's a sluice gate. Who else will be able to appear? And you're going to have to start thinking about lawyers and all that sort of other riffraff that might want to come into your doors to appearances. And you might have to say the comments on that. Just in terms of Rule 68, the undertakings and the once a inspector gets an undertaking from an employer and there's a compliance order, I presume that the employer can come and challenge that compliance order and go through an arbitration, and that they would give evidence and you'd have to go through the whole process over there. You want to try and put it as a con-ob, which is fine, I don't have a problem with that. Because you do want to truncate it somewhat, but you can still then be saddled with a two-day arbitration, for instance, and you can imagine what that would do to your time limits in terms of pressure. I look forward to coming down there and getting my teeth stuck into that. And of course, the people you'll be opposing are the labour inspectors. Not so much the actual claimants. They won't be the applicants to that. It will be the Department of Labour that's applicant. Am I right? And maybe you can comment on that as well. Once a compliance order is given to an employer, my understanding is that the employer would be told in the compliance order you have X amount of days. There would be a proper form saying you have 14 days in which to respond and object, otherwise it becomes deemed to be you don't have to go back to the employer, I presume. Okay, so that's my understanding, and that you could then just take a default against the employer if they have an objective. And I just wanted you to comment on that. Some of the submissions we've heard is that they want to try and make it criminal. One of the trade unions, I think, came forward with that. They wanted to have some sort of criminal. I don't know what your comment is on that, but obviously it would take it completely out of your jurisdiction because you don't have any jurisdiction for criminal law, and I'd be interested in your comment on that. The other thing is, you said, which is a novel concept because the Labour Court has done this, that if there's a ruling, a compliance order, and the employer now wants to object, that they would have to put some money in and give the security. I presume then, and it would be interesting to hear your comment on that, that you'll open up some sort of trust account. And I don't know if you have the authority to open a trust account. I can't just give you the money and you'll keep it in your pocket in the meantime. I presume you're going to tell me how you're going to do this, because my understanding, and that'll be new law, because only certain people can open trust accounts. And the CCMA doesn't have law for that. So you're going to have to start exploring that as well. As to how that can be done. You said over here, Section 73, and I'm sorry, Madam Chair, but I enjoyed this part.
Honourable Brethren, you've misbehaved previously, but you came into order, so let's keep it that way. I'll allow you for now.
I won't be long, I'll be very quick. You spoke about, now before we go to section 73, now that the chairs allowed me to ask a little bit more, the reviews. I understand the reasoning behind wanting a review and not an appeal, but these are purely monetary issues. So I would strongly believe that an appeal is more appropriate than a review. And the appeal would go to where? It would go to the Land Court, I presume. And maybe you could let me have comments as to why you believe a review is more appropriate than an appeal, because it's purely monetary. Whereas in the past, the review has been appropriate because you actually get involved in who did what and who was naughty and all that sort of thing. Over here, it's clear, it's paperwork. Either there is a monetary amount owing or there isn't, nor scientific. And that would be an appeal, I think, but let me hear your comments on that.
I'm sure you are wrapping up now.
I'm not entirely, you know, I've just got a few more. Just in terms of the LRA amendments, I'll leave out all the 73A ones, but just let's have a look at section 127.1 of the Labour Relations Act. I presume you're referring both to individuals and to councils, and not just, because you didn't actually make that absolutely clear. So you feel that you should have the right, because you accredited the individual, you should have the right to take away their accreditation. And then I presume there will also be a set of rules over there that individual can challenge it. I'd like you to expand a little bit on that as well. And it's the same with the council, the bargaining council, or whatever body, say, call it TAFISA, or whatever other body there is, they would have the right then in terms of that to challenge it. And I presume they'll challenge that in the Labour Court, not at the CCMA. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Begram. Mr. Moriani, can you respond to that?
I'll be quick, Chair. Let me start with Honourable Begram. On page 4 of our presentation, you requested us to explain on the issue of worker, if I understand the question correctly. Workers who fall outside of the definition of employee in terms of the LRA and Basic Conditions Employment Act would be entitled to a claim to the CCMA to enforce the national minimum wage. If you compare the two definitions, you will see that actually they're not exactly the same. One excludes the independent contract. So it's a balancing act between the basic conditions and what you find in other things. But the whole purpose is just to make sure that any outstanding payment is paid, no one is outside the act. That's the whole idea. If you look, we checked it, we did a comparator on what the definition is in terms of 213, and you look at the definition of basic conditions, and now what is brought as worker, which is different slightly with an independent contractor. You can see the balancing, the idea is that no one should fall into the curve. And the more all-embracing is the worker one compared to the employee one. That's how we understood it. I know there's been a debate also about that. On page 5 on the condemnation. Yeah, this was just an agreement, there's no issue there. And then page 6, on the objection. On what process will be followed in doing that. Our traditional approach is conciliation arbitration. That's the traditional approach. We have looked at it. That can we really proceed straight to arbitration on an objection? Because you can still do it in papers. Because we're talking about a pay dispute. There is, what other evidence can you present other than this is what is owed and this is what you must pay? So it's a simplified process that we're going to find to define a very simple process that we can use. Sometimes we can have a process like judges do in chambers, where you look at this is what was supposed to be paid, this was not paid. You can dispense with that purely on paper as well, unless there's other material factors which the arbitrator will have to take a more inquisitorial approach, because in all likelihood you're going to have unsophisticated parties before you. So we are going to design a quick approach that is not complicated, that doesn't take you to the full throttle of an arbitration. But if we have to, we will do so. So we were looking at that because it's a new process and we have no experience on how exactly it happens. But having discussed and having met with inspections, it's a very simplified process. So we don't want to come and say, refer 30 days and then you wait. But it's an objection of an existing order. So you can deal with that quite, which will come to that issue raised about, shouldn't you need an appeal instead of a review on such a matter? I can admit to you now that we had a long debate about it. We said in the Department of Labor, a very long, and we had Professor Paul Benjamin with us. Originally, what we submitted, it had an appeal, actually. It had an appeal until we hit a snag and said, so now we're going to have two types of arbitration awards that we issue. The one that relates to the pay dispute, which is only amenable to an appeal, and now you're going to have another one that is subject to 145, which is a review. But both of them takes you to court. But the only difference between the two is that the review focuses mainly on process. An appeal goes to the merits. And if you look at the nature of the claim you're talking about, it is really going to be about the merits. I don't owe 100 rand, it's actually 120 rand. And if you do that, you can't limit yourself to process, because I'm not sure what process will even be there to talk about. Then appeal sounds more appealing. We had that debate there. So because of that controversy of two types of awards, and then this other one of the review started encroaching on the other, we ended up in the review one. But you spotted correctly that we really struggled with that. We ended up with a review for conformity and consistency. But a good case can be made that actually an appeal is more appropriate than an appeal. I will admit that. In fact, Paul was actually more into the appeal one than the review. Yeah, we're very strongly about that, because it is about the actual payment, how much is owed and have you paid and have you not paid. And that's the end of the inquiry. It can go beyond. So that's the process that we'll have to look at. Yes, you're correct, Honorable Bakran, that the 15% is conservative. Yes, it is. We had a full slide in presentation looked at since when we opened doors, when we started with 67,000 cases. We looked at 2002 amendments, we looked at 2015 amendments and the rate of increase. And then we were conservative in coming up to 15% based on that approach. But I do agree with you. If you look at the type of claims that we're talking about, it's about pay. In fact, it will even include dispute about deductions of salary. An unlawful deduction of the salary is a pay dispute. It will come to the CCMA, and we've had a number of referrals like those, but we never got to deal with them, because at the time we did not have the jurisdiction to deal with them. If you reverse it, and that now that we have the jurisdiction, yes, the number will come about 15% based on our predictions. Then we'll never argue against that. I've dealt with the worker definition, because you're correct. You see, if you look at the worker, and if you look at the definition, it tells that anyone who assists the employee in the execution of their work, then he's a worker. So anyone, by any definition, if the only test is did you assist the employer in the execution of, if the answer is yes, it means we have jurisdiction. But if you look at that, you know, loosely, that's what it means, literally, which then broadens your scope about who's under it. One will have a serious difficulty to argue why shouldn't an independent contractor be one of those referrals as well, because he assists the employer in. But the other definition says excluding independent contractors is more specific, but worker is different. So that's the comparative of the definitions. that we got ourselves entangled in that as well, trying to understand it all, and what the purpose is behind the work and the employee. One is limited, the other one is expanded. So that's how we understood it. It is correct that all underpayments come to the 59, in any form of shape, when it comes to the basic condition, leave pay, anything that sounds in money that is underpayment or outstanding payment will come to the commission as matter stand, which then challenges the 15% that we're talking about, that it may actually be much more than what we had anticipated. There's a support for the rulemaking. Now, the difficulty we have with not having a legislative provision that gives the board the power to make the rule is that power is only seen in the LFA. We have been challenged before and we lost at the LAC, where we made certain things which we didn't have power to make. They said we didn't have the power to do so because the legislation doesn't give you power to do so. From that experience, that's why we're making this request. It's easy to make it in the rule. We can easily make that honorable backup. But because of that experience, we needed protection that at least, if anything, there should be a referral to the LFA that the provisions of the LFA in terms of section 115 will apply mutatis mutandis. Then we're fine with that. Then we're covered. There's no additional clause that looks exactly like that but under the PCA. But we just need any reference that says we have the power to create the rules on how we deal with matters in terms of basic conditions. So that's the idea behind that. Yes, actually, if we look at the question that the opponent is actually the DG, not the employee, it's actually correct, because that's the one who's referring. So it goes to the DG, from DG comes to us. So we even debated, is there a need for even an employee to be there? But the bottom line is, not the party, really, strictly speaking, because it comes from the DG. But the flip side of it is that an employee does not necessarily have to go to the DG for that. They can approach us directly. Without following that rule, then the employee becomes a direct party to the proceedings. The only difference there is that when it's such a direct referral, it's without the undertaking, it's without the compliance order. It means we're starting a hearing afresh, where we have to go through the process and issue the award. Yet if it's through the DG, a compliance order is already issued, or an undertaking for payment is already there. So all the dispute of facts that may have arisen have already been taken care of, because they're in the compliance order. But if it comes directly, it starts afresh. We at some point, we're wondering why the duality of that. We even questioned that should it even be going to the DG to start off with. But because of the compliance order and all of that, it comes through them. This also deals with the question of the amendment to who can appear at the CCMA. Because in as far as that part is concerned, if you look at that specific section, there are certain employees who cannot receive delegations of the DG because of their level or rank. That's where the problem came. When we raise the provision, we realize that then this is going to be a problem. So we are faced with a practicality problem, that those who appear, it's actually not the inspector that appears at the labor court. And those that are appearing to us in terms of the bill, it's not the inspector. It's those secretary employees who are trained, we are told, who do those applications. But the bill is proposing inspectors. So there was even a suggestion that shouldn't we say that any person delegated by the DG, if you accept that provision, but others will be excluded because of the rank and level that is prescribed in the basic condition itself. So it's still limited. So that's why we say we have to have a relook at that. Because if it's limited to inspectors, no one else other than inspectors can appear. Those persons will either have to, whoever appears, must be designated and appointed as an inspector to start off with, for them to have a right of appearance before the commission. So that's where it's coming from, that discussion. It's an interesting question of the security. Security doesn't have to be the actual money, I understand. It can be exactly the security to pay, it's not the actual money. It can be any form. But to the extent that it has to be money, we have not even thought about that. That's what we should be doing. We don't even want to get involved in such things because it will complicate our process. And we don't. But I think it is worthy of relooking how the current practice in the labor court works in terms of the section 145 and see if we can get an adaptation from that suits within our jurisdiction, but still trying to achieve the very same purpose of ensuring that the security when somebody challenges a decision, a compliance order, and which is similar to challenging the award in terms of the arbitration. And absolutely, the moment it touches on criminality, we have no jurisdiction at all. That's far away from us. So that part I do agree with. And then in terms of the appeal is more appropriate, I think I've dealt with that. Is there room for challenge on?
I believe you are wrapping up.
Yeah, just one last point, Jefferson. That is the room for challenge I accept. If you have such a power to withdraw the accreditation, if you're not happy with it, as we have always been challenged, that power will lie with the Labour Court, or actually the normal courts in terms of the normal reviews, that our decision is not rational or our decision is not reasonable. That we can't legislate against. And while we would enjoy the whole power to have no challenge, but we can't stop that. People will always challenge a decision that we make. But at least we must have an important legislative base on why we make certain decisions, because we've got power to do so in terms of the law, not as right into or as assumed. Yeah. So, Jefferson, I will wrap up there.
Thank you very much. Are you there?
Yes, yes, yes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moriyandi. I think you broke the record today. Yes, but I know you just like that. Honourable members, unfortunately, we are forced to break for dinner at this stage because it's already ready in the dining hall, in the old assembly restaurant. So it's now 6:01. I'll allow us to be back at about 7:20. Thank you.
Save this, isn't it?
Yeah.